This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is President Barack Obama, who has fulfilled another of his post-presidency goals to write his memoir. Volume 1, titled A Promised Land, was just published. In the introduction, he writes, "I confess that there have been times during the course of writing this book, as I've reflected on my presidency and all that's happened since, when I've had to ask myself whether I was too tempered in speaking the truth as I saw it, too cautious in either word or deed, convinced as I was that by appealing to what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature, I stood a greater chance of leading us in the direction of the America we've been promised. I don't know. What I can say for certain is that I'm not yet ready to abandon the possibility of America, not just for the sake of future generations, but for all humankind." He goes on to wonder if our experiment in democracy can work, to see if we can actually live up to the meaning of our creed. He writes, "The jury is still out." The book begins with his youth and ends with him fulfilling one of his goals as president, killing Osama bin Laden on May 1st, 2011, in the third year of his presidency. We recorded our interview Tuesday afternoon. President Obama, it is an honor to have you on our show. Thank you so much for coming.
It's great to be on, Terry.
So I want to start by asking you, do you ever wake up thinking, I wish I still had the weight of the world on my shoulders?
I really don't. I tell my friends sometimes who ask me, wouldn't you have liked a third term or a fourth term, that I actually think it is a healthy aspect of our democracy that you get 8 years at most, and then it's time for some fresh legs. If somebody asked me what aspects of the job I miss, I'd say the camaraderie of an amazing team. The policy work is fascinating. I joke that if I could sit in some sweatpants and a t-shirt in my home office and relay information to a front man or front woman who was doing all the pomp and circumstance and ceremonial stuff, then I might enjoy doing a little more policy making. But I think 8 years gives you a good stretch of time to be able to get some stuff done.
So getting back to the concerns you write about in the introduction about American democracy, do you think that President Trump has broken democracy, not just because of all the norms he broke, like refusing to concede and not to give President-elect Biden access to the funding and classified information that presidents-elect are supposed to receive, but he's also opened the door for another president or elected leader to do the same thing. He set a precedent that you can do this. Maybe he won't get away with it for much longer, but he's gotten away with it so far. And most of the Republicans in Congress said nothing or supported him.
Well, I think the last point you made is the one I'm probably most concerned about. Donald Trump is who he is. And even prior to his election, it was clear that he was going to behave in a certain way. It didn't get tempered by the presidency. What I was surprised by over the last 4 years is the complicity of other Republican elected officials and their unwillingness to call him when he was breaking norms or straining some of our democratic institutions. I don't believe democracy is broken. We just had record turnout. We had an election in which, despite what the president's saying, you're seeing state officials run an orderly process, and even Republican officials who are responsible for counting votes, doing so in a way that reflects their integrity. But there's no doubt that it's been strained.
Donald Trump has made so many false statements, made so many baseless accusations, amplified so many conspiracy theories. For you personally, it starts with birtherism, that you were born in Kenya, that you were constitutionally ineligible to be president. And posting your birth certificate, posting the newspaper clipping announcing your birth in Hawaii, wasn't adequate evidence to convince him or his followers that you were an American citizen born in Hawaii. To me personally, following this when it happened, it seemed kind of ridiculous and silly at first. And then I started realizing people are taking this seriously. A lot of people believe this. This matters. What was that process like for you? Did it seem ridiculous and silly at first? And then did you realize that you had to take it seriously?
Yes, it seemed silly at first. It seemed silly in the middle, and it seemed silly at the end. But despite initially treating it as a bad joke, what I was forced to acknowledge was that it was consuming time and energy and bandwidth on my staff, and that ultimately I ended up having to address it directly in the White House briefing room just to get it to stop so that we could get on with the business of discussing budgets and the Afghan war and other important issues. And in this case, by the way, and this I think is important to note, it wasn't just the Fox Newses of the world or the Rush Limbaughs of the world that were amplifying this baseless and ultimately racist claim. It was mainstream media. I mean, some of the same folks who were very critical now of Donald Trump and have been critical throughout his presidency regularly had him on their show because he boosted ratings. They thought, well, you know, this is a spectacle that attracts eyeballs. And that was frustrating to me. It gave me a sense of the danger of, you know, in this mass media environment, if somebody is willing and able to just consistently repeat a falsehood, particularly one that taps into maybe pre-existing anxieties that certain segments of the American people feel, then it can end up getting traction. And the internet's made it even worse.
You know, you list some of the ridiculous claims about you that were made, and here's one I hadn't heard, that you'd been a gay prostitute. Like, where did that come from?
Well, but this is my point. It doesn't come from anywhere. It what you saw early on in our campaign, and this precedes Donald Trump. This is why I say Donald Trump he's been an accelerant, but he didn't cause all this. The original birther argument actually traces back to a perennial eccentric right-wing candidate in Illinois when I was running for the U.S. Senate, years before I was president. It resurfaced during my presidential run in 2008, along with notions that I had been educated at a madrasas and that I had been a drug dealer, and, you know, the one that you just mentioned. We had, at times during the campaign, we'd joke around and we'd list some of the latest conspiracy theories that were floating around. I think what's changed is that kind of hothouse of conspiracy theorizing, that paranoid style of politics in America, that's always been there. It's just that it wouldn't pop. What's changed is just that the barriers for that breaking out into mainstream sort of circulation, that started to, whatever those barriers were, those started to break down. The guardrails broke down during the course of my presidency, partly driven by technology, partly driven by the realization by certain politicians that, you know what, we don't get punished if we don't tell the truth, that there's no sanction against us, that if there's a lot of noise, I mean, I think Steve Bannon explicitly said, we're just going to fill up the information pipeline with excrement, and it'll get very cloudy. It doesn't really matter whether ultimately what we're saying is disproven. It creates confusion and uncertainty in the minds of voters, and that's enough for our purposes of getting power.
Yeah, you don't know what's true and what's false.
That's exactly right.
In the introduction, in the preface to your memoir, which I read an excerpt of in our introduction, you talked about the questions you had about, you know, American democracy in this time, and you wondered if you were being like too cautious in word or deed when you were president. And I'm wondering if part of that was because if as a black man you were felt you had to be more cautious and not show anger to avoid sparking some Americans' fears of the stereotypes of an angry black man. The kind of thing Key and Peele used to play on in their sketch about you.
That was, which was one of the smarter sketches on comedy shows during my presidency. Look, I think there's some of that. You know, there's the famous story about why Jackie Robinson was chosen by Ranch Rickey to be the first black major league ball player. And it wasn't just because he was an outstanding baseball player. It was also because Rickey felt that Jackie Robinson had the temperament to keep his cool. And there was probably some element in how I operated that just has to do with my temperament. I'm not somebody who's quick to rise or gets too low. Some of that probably has to do with having been born in Hawaii. Yeah, you don't have a lot of reason to complain if it's 80 degrees and sunny and the beach is close by. And that's part of who I am. But part of it was, no doubt, a recognition that as a first, in this case, the first leader of the free world, that I had to get things right and that I had to make sure that when I spoke, I was reacting not out of emotion, but out of clear convictions and principles, and that I was embodying the kind of responsible leadership that I had promised. And that's probably why I write in the preface that there might have been times where I tamped down on what I was feeling in the moment, in ways that by the end of my presidency, I was less prone to do. I think this was partly a problem of the first couple of years where I was much more embracing of a certain way of being president. And you know, by the end of my presidency, I was like, look, I've been to this rodeo many times. I'm going to say, you know, whatever I think about certain things. Now, I think that going to the point of race, it wasn't as if there weren't reasons for me occasionally to bite my tongue. There was evidence, in fact, that when I did speak my mind, that there was always a price to pay.
So many things that you did get done were undone by President Trump: the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris Peace Accord, DACA, the Dreamers Act, ongoing attempts for years now to undo the Affordable Care Act. Its fate now rests with the Supreme Court. You know, the Republicans have pledged to end Obamacare for years. How have you dealt emotionally with watching some of your accomplishments as president get canceled and undone by the Trump presidency?
23 million people still have health care that didn't have it if we hadn't passed that law. And I actually believe, not because of any inside information, but based on the arguments that were made before the Supreme Court, that this will be the last gasp of trying to undo it, and that it will have been a permanent and beneficial expansion of health insurance to millions of Americans when all is said and done. One of the ways I came to think about the presidency was as a relay race. You get the baton, you run your race, then you hand off the baton. And all you have control over is that portion of the race that you run. And I could say unequivocally that the country was much better off by the time I finished my race than when I started. But you understand that in a democracy, some of the steps you take can be undone. Some of them end up having more of an impact than the laws alone would assume. That doesn't mean that you don't sometimes fume about why are they doing this. There have been repeated occasions, not just with Donald Trump, but even during my presidency, where I would ask my Republican colleagues, all right, if this is not what you want, tell me what it is that you think we should be doing. Give me your healthcare plan, because I promise you, if it's better, if it's cheaper and it provides better coverage to people and it's more effective, I don't have pride of authorship. I will take your idea. And what became apparent over time was opposition to the idea, or at least the author, in this case me, rather than a particular policy outcome that they were looking for.
We're facing a really bad COVID winter. Some cities are shutting down virtually, including Philadelphia, where I live. You faced the H1N1 virus, which, you know, of course, wasn't as lethal or as contagious as COVID, but still a pretty potent virus. You dealt with Ebola. You worked on pandemic preparedness even when you were in the Senate. Were there safeguards and plans that your administration put into place to protect against the next pandemic that the Trump administration did not take advantage of?
Yes. I think it's pretty well known. We had set up a pandemic preparedness task force inside the White House, which involved various agencies, and they would do regular tabletop exercises to figure out how we're going to respond. We put together a pandemic playbook, which we actually gave to the incoming Trump administration, indicating here are the steps that you need to take. And if, in fact, this ends up being an airborne virus that is highly contagious, then the steps that are going to need to be taken in advance of any development of a vaccine or any other kind of medical intervention is wearing masks, social distancing, so forth and so on. We had around the world set up a global security program in cooperation with other countries so that when we saw a virus initially emerge, we'd have an early warning system. A number of the individuals that we had assigned and were in China had been pulled back, and the Trump administration had eliminated the task force that we had inside the White House and apparently never read the playbook. So look, as I've said publicly, any president would have had trouble with this pandemic. It is more virulent, more dangerous, more contagious than anything we've seen since the Spanish flu back in 1918. Even countries that have managed it well have still seen significant outbreaks. But, you know, Canada's a pretty good example of what an administration or a government that is following the science and the recommendations of epidemiologists can accomplish. Canada's death rate per capita is about 39% of what ours is. And that is tens of thousands of people who would not be dead if we had been as effective as Canada was in dealing with this disease.
With everything you've said and with your analogy to the relay race, still, it must be so...
aggravating?
Yes, thank you. Aggravating is a good word. Yes. How do you deal with all that aggravation? Where do you channel it?
You work out a little harder in the morning. You hit that treadmill a little tougher. One of the things that is a strength of mine, I think sometimes maybe people consider it a weakness because it frustrates them to see me not get more frustrated, is I tend to take the long view on things. And I try to remind myself that history does not just go forward. It goes sideways. It goes backwards sometimes. The path of progress is bumpy, and there are going to be setbacks. And look, you know, the Civil War and the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments were followed by Jim Crow. and the Klan and lynching. And that was horrific and heartbreaking. That didn't negate the importance of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. It just meant that some bad stuff happens, but you keep on trying. And I think that's how I ended up feeling about what I got done during the presidency. I felt that we had advanced the causes that I cared deeply about and that mattered to the American people. Not all of them were going to stick exactly the way I wanted. That didn't negate the importance of pushing to try to get that stuff done, even in those areas where Donald Trump completely reversed course. Now, look, do I occasionally curse when I'm reading the headlines over the last 4 years? Yes, I do. Have I had some venting or ranting on occasion with Michelle over the dinner table? Absolutely. I don't want to pretend like there haven't been moments where the same is true in the presidency. I mean, I try to show in this book that whatever may have looked like no drama Obama didn't mean that there I wouldn't be going back after the press conference or the public statement and figuratively kicking the chair over.
Mr. President, thank you so much for talking with us. It has really been an honor to talk with you. I hope that you find the time to come back to our show when you publish your second memoir, the second volume.
I will make the same promise I made before the first one. You know, we'll get there.
Oh, great. Thank you.
All right. I enjoyed it. Right. Thank you, Terry.
Be well. Thank you so much. Barack Obama has just published the first of his two-volume memoir. It's called A Promised Land. The British director Steve McQueen, who's best known for movies like Widows and the Oscar-winning 12 Years a Slave, has a new project unlike anything he's ever done. It's called Small Axe, and it's an anthology series of five films set in London's West Indian community. Our film critic Justin Chang says that in a year of galvanizing anti-racist protests, these films reveal a picture of black lives and structural racism outside the U.S. New films in the collection will be rolled out every Friday on Amazon Prime Video between now and December 18th. The first in the series is now streaming. Here's Justin's review.
Steve McQueen has made searingly powerful films about historical injustice, from slavery in the American South to a 1981 hunger strike in a Northern Irish prison. But only now has he dramatized the experiences of black women and men in the UK, specifically the West Indian neighborhoods of London, where he grew up. He clearly has a lot to say. His anthology, Small Axe, which he directed and co-wrote, consists of five dramatic films, each one telling a different story set between the 1960s and the 1980s. I haven't seen the last two films in the series, Alex Weedle and Education, which will air later in December. But the first three are terrific. Engrossing, vibrantly shot, and superbly acted, they draw us deep into a community defined by its strong bonds, often expressed in joyous scenes of characters singing, dancing, and sharing meals. But they also show how hard won that joy is. The first film, Mangrove, is an electrifying account of a landmark 1971 trial that exposed anti-black racism within London's Metropolitan Police. Sean Parks plays Frank Critchlow, a Trinidadian immigrant who owns a restaurant called The Mangrove that becomes a favorite meeting place for black Londoners. Before long, it's being raided by white police constables, driving away patrons and destroying Frank's property. Darkus Howe, an activist played by a sensational Malachi Kirby, urges Frank to respond to this campaign of intimidation by organizing a protest.
My brother, this government will never take up its responsibility to you and this community, not unless it sees people on the street. Let us organize a demonstration.
We're not in Trinidad now, boy. This is Notting Hill.
This is Notting Hill. This place, the Mangrove, it is Notting Hill. Whether you can recognize so or not, this is the front line. The mangrove, this is community, the black community is your community. The black community who rely on the mangrove just as much as you rely on them. Take it to the street.
The community organizes a march to a local police station where Frank, Darkus, and seven other demonstrators, known as the Mangrove Nine, are arrested and charged with inciting a riot. That setup might bring to mind the recent film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, but the legal drama here has none of Aaron Sorkin's glib self-satisfaction. It's also more cinematic. McQueen's camera boldly captures the lopsided power dynamics of the courtroom, where dishonest cops and a biased judge seem bent on upholding the status quo. But justice of a sort does prevail, and Mangrove becomes a stirring tribute to the power of impassioned homegrown activists like Frank, Darkus, and Althea Jones. She's played by a terrific Letitia Wright, so memorable in the Marvel superhero movie Black Panther. Mangrove has a clear thematic link to the third Small Axe film, Red, White, and Blue. It's another fact-based story of police injustice, but a more somber, intimate one. John Boyega, known for the most recent Star Wars trilogy, gives a genuinely star-making performance here as a cop named Leroy Logan. He joins the force in 1983, hoping to fight the institutional racism that has already devastated his community, including his own father, Kenneth, who was violently beaten by two cops for a parking violation. Leroy believes the only way to transform an unjust system is from within. Easier said than done. He witnesses and experiences no shortage of mistreatment by his white colleagues, especially when they ignore his call for backup while he's chasing a suspect. The real-life Leroy Logan went on to spend 3 decades with the police and became one of its most important reformers. But his brilliant career is only hinted at in Red, White, and Blue. This is Leroy's origin story, a reminder that even the smallest steps can bring about necessary change. The sublime second film in the anthology, Lover's Rock, is one of its most unique. It's the only story here that isn't based on real-life figures. Arriving between the harder-hitting Mangrove and Red, White, and Blue, it feels like a respite, a blast of pure, unfiltered bliss. The movie takes place over one glorious night at a 1980 house party in Notting Hill. McQueen revels in the little details. We watch as a few men clear away furniture and hook up speakers, while a group of women work and sing in the kitchen, cooking goat curry and other Jamaican dishes. The title refers to Lover's Rock, a genre of reggae music that will figure heavily on the evening's playlist. But it also establishes the movie as a romance between two beautiful strangers, played by Amara J. St. Aubin and Michael Ward, who seal their mutual attraction on the dance floor. Running a short 68 minutes, Lover's Rock is a thrillingly immersive piece of filmmaking. The gently swaying camera puts us right there in the room as everyone sings and dances the night away, pulling us into a kind of trance in which time itself comes to a rapturous standstill. Given McQueen's tendency to focus on human suffering, it's wonderful to see him cut loose here. Lover's Rock is easily the most exhilarating film he's ever made. It shows that joy itself can be an act of defiance, an expression of a community's life force and its will to survive.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Small Axe, the new collection of 5 films by Steve McQueen. The first film in the series is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. A new film will be released each Friday until December 18th. My guest John Wiener hopes that President Trump does not watch Aaron Sorkin's new film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven. Wiener wrote in an article published last month in The Nation that he feared Trump would take away the wrong message and tell his Attorney General William Barr to do with the leaders of today's protest movements, like Black Lives Matter, what Nixon did to the Chicago Seven and put them on trial for conspiracy to cross state lines and incite riot. Wiener is the author of a book about the Chicago 7 trial that includes a very abridged version of the trial transcript. The book, Conspiracy in the Streets, was first published in 2006. It was reprinted to coincide with Aaron Sorkin's film, which is now streaming on Netflix. The Chicago 7, originally the Chicago 8, were leaders of the movement against the war in Vietnam. In August of 1968, they organized protests that drew thousands of people from around the country to Chicago to coincide with the Democratic National Convention that was being held there. This was the convention that nominated Hubert Humphrey, who lost to Richard Nixon. The protesters were met with thousands of police, National Guardsmen, and soldiers, resulting in battles that were broadcast on national TV, shocking Americans who watched as young people were clubbed and tear-gassed. 8 months later, early in Nixon's presidency, eight leaders of the political and cultural left, including Bobby Seale, a co-founder of the Black Panthers, were charged with conspiracy to incite riot. Seale, who was chained and gagged in the courtroom during part of the trial, was later severed from the trial and was not retried for the Chicago charges. Wiener writes, "At the end of the 60s, it seemed that all the conflicts in America were distilled and then acted out in the courtroom of the trial." Wiener is also the author of the book Set the Night on Fire about the protest movements in 1960s L.A., and he wrote an earlier book about John Lennon's FBI files. John Wiener, welcome back to Fresh Air. The anti-war protests that we're talking about were staged to coincide with the Democratic National Convention. Why were they protesting at the convention site in Chicago?
Well, the war in Vietnam had been basically a war started and escalated by Democratic presidents, especially Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson had to withdraw from his own reelection campaign, something that has never happened before or since, because there was so much opposition to him from within his own party, because there were now 500,000 troops in Vietnam, and it was clear that America was never going to win this war. So if you wanted to protest the war, you had to protest against the Democrats. The Republicans really didn't have much to do with it. And that's why the anti-war leaders set out to organize what they hoped would be hundreds of thousands of people protesting. In the end, it was one of the smaller protests of the 60s. But as you said, the violence of the police riot, and the police riot on TV made it a historic event.
How did it turn into a riot? What happened?
Well, this is the subject of the trial raised this issue repeatedly. There's, of course, two views of how this happened. The Nixon Justice Department's view was that leaders of the protest movement conspired to sort of trick naive young people into coming to Chicago and then provoked a riot in violation of federal law. The defense argued that truthfully, they had tried repeatedly to get permits to make this a legal protest, and they were denied first by the city and then by the courts. They couldn't stop people from coming to protest. And it's pretty clear that the mayor of Chicago, Richard J. Daley, kind of authorized, not formally, but informally, the police to attack and beat the demonstrators repeatedly, day after day. And indeed, an independent investigation after all these events called it a police riot.
So the city issued a curfew at 11 o'clock during the nights of the protests. And when the protesters didn't leave, that, I think, is when the police attacked them?
Yes. We need to make it clear here. There were two very different protests that were organized. One was the kind of traditional protest march that wanted to go to the convention site and call on the Democrats to end the war. That was the one that was organized by the National Mobilization Committee, the MOB, we called it, Dave Dellinger, Rennie Davis, and Tom Hayden. And then there was a separate protest, the Yippies, organized what they called a Festival of Life in Grant Park to challenge what they called the Festival of Death at the Democratic National Convention. Their protest was going to be in the park. It was going to involve music, dancing. They also said perhaps public fornication, perhaps nude bathing at the beaches. The Festival of Life of the Counterculture And everyone was encouraged who wanted to come to that to camp out in the park. And the police said they couldn't stay overnight in the park. And so that became the flashpoint, you're right, of the police violence.
Many of the protesters were injured. I think hundreds were hospitalized.
Yeah, including Rennie Davis, was very, got a concussion, covered with blood, hospitalized. It was bad.
The defendants on the trial come from the cultural left and the political left, and there's a lot of divisions between them in terms of their tactics, their philosophy, their strategy, and you could see that in how they tried to use the trial to make their larger points about the war and about what was going wrong with America. Can you talk about their different strategies at the trial?
Yeah. Both groups wanted to use the trial to present the case to the American people that they wanted to put the government on trial for the war in Vietnam. That they agreed on. How to do that was where they had different ideas. Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, let's call them Abbie and Jerry, wanted to use ridicule and humor and disruptions to desanctify the courtroom and delegitimize the judge and undermine the prosecution. And Dave Dellinger was kind of into that too. He was openly defiant of the judge and the prosecutors. Rennie Davis and Tom Hayden wanted to have a more sober kind of trial where they would challenge the factual basis of what the prosecution was saying and insist on talking about the war at every opportunity. In practice, there was a lot of disruption, and in practice, the judge resolutely refused to let them bring up Vietnam. He kept saying Vietnam has nothing to do with this trial. Objection sustained. So we saw both of these in the courtroom, and the trial, of course, lasted almost 5 months, so there were many opportunities for both strategies to be attempted.
Judge Julius Hoffman, as you point out in your book, he seemed to represent everything that was unjust and oppressive about the status quo at the time. He was 74 at the time of the trial. He had graduated from law school in 1915, which was very far away from the cultural values of 1968. And he did things that were just really remarkable by any standard, including having Bobby Seale when he was still a defendant in the trial. Bobby Seale was one of the founders of the Black Panthers. Hoffman had him bound and gagged, and Seale's lawyer had been hospitalized, so Seale didn't have representation. He wanted to represent himself. Hoffman refused to allow him to do that. And when Seale kept protesting, that's when Hoffman had him bound and gagged. How are you allowed to do that in an American courtroom? How was Hoffman allowed to do that? Wasn't there anybody who could say, you don't do that in America? Anybody who could stop that kind of thing from happening?
You know, I had never heard of it happening before either, and I'm kind of amazed that the prosecution didn't tell the judge not to do this. I mean, it was a completely horrifying spectacle. Threw the courtroom into turmoil. It went on for 4 days. Bobby Seale was a fiercely proud and strong person who kept trying to shout through his gag that he demanded his right to represent himself. A lot of this was in front of the jury. I would have thought that the prosecution would have been worried about the jury being, as we say, tainted by this spectacle. And of course, eventually, after 4 days, Bobby Seale was severed, and that was the end of his presence in the courtroom, although the defense then brought him back as a defense witness a couple months later. But it never should have happened. It was completely horrible. It was a spectacle to the entire country, in fact, to the entire world. You can be sure that in Europe and in Africa and in South America, people saw the courtroom drawings. There were no photographs or film or video allowed in the courtroom, but there were courtroom drawings of a black man gagged in chains in an American courtroom.
What was Bobby Seale doing as a defendant in the first place?
he really shouldn't have been there. He had not been any part of these demonstrations. The Panthers were not planning to demonstrate, didn't call on their members to demonstrate at the Chicago National Convention. And in fact, they called it, a great phrase, Custeristic. It was like, you know, being Custer heading into the battle that he was sure to be massacred in. So Bobby Seale was in Chicago for a total of 4 hours. He gave a speech in Grant Park in the afternoon, which was mostly about the Black Panthers' 10-point program, defund the police and, you know, black power in black communities. But since the Panthers were the most famous black radical group in America, Nixon wanted to make them part of what was going to be the biggest show trial of radicals in America. So he was added, and probably it was part of the prosecution strategy also to, you know, frighten a jury of middle-class white people with an angry black man.
It didn't work out the way they expected, did it?
No. Partly, it was as you say, it was because of Judge Julius Hoffman did this most unexpected thing. He should have allowed Bobby Seale to have an attorney. I mean, that's kind of basic, you know.
It's his constitutional right. Like, I don't understand how this was allowed to happen. Yeah.
You make a good point. It was his constitutional right, and that's what he kept asserting. Hoffman, in some way, you know, when you read the transcript now, you just can't believe a judge would ever do this. It's horrifying, and in some ways it's hilarious. I mean, every time the prosecution says objection, the judge says sustained. And every time the defense says objection, the judge says overruled. He doesn't even let them state their objection. So he's unbelievably biased, which of course led to the entire, all the convictions being overturned on appeal. But in some ways, in retrospect, this played very much into the hands of the defendants who wanted to expose, you know, the injustice of the American legal system and how the courts were in the service of the repressive forces of the Nixon administration. I mean, it could not possibly have been any clearer, and any other judge would have had a very different kind of trial that didn't fulfill everything that the radicals were saying about justice in America.
So we've been talking about Judge Julius Hoffman. What are some of the things that he did, some of the other things he did that were so norm-breaking for a judge?
Well, he, in some ways, aside from having a black man chained and gagged in the courtroom, I'd say the second most outrageous thing he did was not allowing the former Attorney General Ramsey Clark to testify. Ramsey Clark was prepared to testify that the Democratic administration thought there was no basis for a conspiracy trial of these people and that they did not cause a riot. And Hoffman banned the defense from presenting that testimony in the courtroom and from presenting that witness in the courtroom, and didn't even allow the jury to know that the former attorney general had been a scheduled witness and was not allowed to appear. And of course, the most fundamental thing, which we've mentioned before, was refusing to allow Bobby Seale to have his attorney present, and then refusing his repeated demands that he be allowed to represent himself, completely unconstitutional.
So how did the Chicago 7 trial end?
Well, here the film is a little misleading. The film has a happy ending with Tom Hayden defying the judge while everybody cheers. That's the way Aaron Sorkin likes his films to end. But in real life, the trial ended with guilty verdicts against 5 of the 7 defendants. Everyone was found innocent on the conspiracy charge, but guilty of incitement to riot. They were then sentenced to 5 years in prison for that crime. And then the judge also gave each one of them long sentences for contempt of court, some as long as 4 years more for contempt of court. Now, normally, if you're being facing more than a 6-month sentence for contempt of court, you get a separate jury trial. He denied them a separate jury trial, despite repeated protests from the attorneys And that also was overturned on appeal. But the end of the trial was a very grim and miserable experience for everybody.
What parallels do you see between the Chicago 7 and the protests of today and how the police have handled those protests?
Well, today's the biggest difference is that today's protests have been 100 times bigger. It wasn't just in one city that people took to the streets and in many places were attacked by the police. It was everywhere in America, big cities and little cities. And it wasn't just young people. It wasn't just black people. It was a very multi-ethnic, multi-racial wave of protests that we had this summer on a scale that we've never seen before in America. So I think what happened this summer is much, much better, much bigger and stronger and smarter than anything that happened in the 60s, including the Chicago convention protests. One of the most important things is there weren't these kinds of splits in the demonstrations of the past summer. They were very focused and very coherent. And, you know, the 60s left, the SDS split into two factions, which kicked each other out. The Black Panthers had a bitter rivalry with Ron Karenga's US organization. We haven't seen anything like that with Black Lives Matter. And, you know, I've thought a lot about why is that? Why is today's protest movement so much better than what we had in the 60s? I think part of it is that Black Lives Matter is an organization that was founded and is led by black women. And they somehow do not have the same kind of, let's call them, macho rivalries and preoccupations that the men of the 60s New Left and the 60s Black Power movement had.
John Wiener, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
John Wiener is the author of the book Conspiracy in the Streets, The Extraordinary Trial of the Chicago 7.